welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Have you ever thought about why you go to a doctor? Do you actually know what you're going for? Most people go because they're told they're supposed to, that preventative care involves being checked out periodically to make sure that you're not sick. But is that really what you're getting? Don't you know when you're sick? I think most people go to the doctor because they're scared. And it's worth considering before going whether a doctor is the right person to see when you're scared. Modern medicine has a complex hierarchy that puts pressure on doctors to do things according to the standard of care. That's a term for the current orthodoxy that dictates what's to be done more to you than for you. In most cases, it's the same for everyone and not individualized, and it's based on symptoms, which increasingly means disease to doctors. Doctors aren't bad people, but the forces that are working on them aren't altruistic. Today's guest, Dr. Oleg Reznik, R-E-Z-N-I-K, is a physician who believes in minimal to no intervention, even though it isn't standard of care. Stay tuned for a discussion about medical decision-making. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. Suppose several hundred marine biologists studied your swimming pool. 47% or 69% or 77% or 83% of the biologists report you've got a shark in your pool. Would you dive in? Would you let your kids dive in? Of the hundreds of studies that have been conducted on the health effects of radiofrequency radiation, the kind of radiation we are exposed to from sources like cell phones and their antennas, cordless phones, wireless routers, and other wireless technologies like the soon-to-be-released iPhone, 47% of those studies found increased cancer risks, 69% found disruptions to cell function, 77% found disruptions to electrical signaling in the body, and 83% found physiological and behavioral disruptions. Last month, a BBC television program caused a minor sensation when it claimed to find wireless networks in schools exposed children to three times the radiation of cell phone antennas. It got the attention of the Health Protection Agency, something like the British equivalent of the FDA. The agency, along with Britain's major teachers' union, are calling for research, precaution, and parental involvement in school decisions to install wireless networks. Of course, experts were quoted to the effect that there's no proof that these exposures cause harm. Those voices are much louder in the United States. To my knowledge, no teachers' union has a precautionary policy or any other kind of policy regarding wireless networks in schools. And our FDA, instead of raising a precautionary voice, tells us that, quote, the scientific evidence does not show that any health problems are associated with using wireless phones, end quote. Unlike the British, they're not even considering wireless networks. So it's no surprise that this modestly important event in Britain was not covered at all in any U.S. news media. While attention is being paid to the effect of non-ionizing radiation in British school children, wireless networks are eagerly promoted in the U.S. It's new, it's hip, it's cheap, it's convenient, it's part of an exciting and excitatory mobile lifestyle. And that's okay because there's no proof that it causes harm. Of course, there's no proof that it's safe either. In fact, proof is a carefully chosen rhetorical device intended to communicate priestly assurances from the experts. Unfortunately, proof has its home in geometry, not science. In science, the preferred term is evidence, the term used by the FDA to the effect that cell phones and, by implication, wireless networks in schools are safe. This makes it easy to say that the FDA's statement is false. As I mentioned, there's a good deal of evidence for a wide range of health effects from wireless technologies. One of the British experts provided assurances about the safety of wireless networks using another clever rhetorical device, one I'm sure you've heard yourself. We've been exposed to radiofrequency radiation for 100 years, he said. If it's harmful, why aren't people dropping like flies? To which the correct answer is, how do you know they aren't? Meanwhile, as we await scientific consensus, Do you want your kids to dive into the wireless swimming pool? A transcript of this editorial is available at the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is editor of the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine. There's more information about him at yourownhealthandfitness.org. And now to our show's topic, medical decision-making, with Dr. Oleg Reznik. Again, it's R-E-Z-N-I-K. Dr. Reznik was born in Odessa, Ukraine. He received his bachelor's degree in neuroscience at New York University and his MD degree at State University of New York. In Salem, Oregon, Dr. Reznik worked at a not-for-profit clinic for the underserved and developed a small practice of his own using a holistic approach to health, doing full-range family practice. His personal interest in the healing potential of the mind has led him to a 9-year apprenticeship with a teacher of mental imagery. He's currently completing a course of study at the American Institute for Medical Imagery. Excuse me. Dr. Reznik is an instructor at OHSU Family Medicine at Richmond. His book is The Secrets of Medical Decision-Making, How to Avoid Becoming a Victim of the Healthcare Machine. And we're very honored to have you on the air, Dr. Reznik.
Yes, thank you, Lena. OHSU stands for Oregon Health and Sciences University.
Thank you.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I knew about New York. I wasn't sure about those initials. So your book does a very meticulous job of describing all the forces acting on medical professionals that prevent them from seeing patients as individuals. What should people go to doctors for?
It's in my mind, at least, it's a somewhat individual question, and it depends on the person, depends on what kind of lifestyle they are living. The question, should everyone go prophylactically to a doctor? My answer would definitely be no. Now, this may be useful and definitely would be useful for people who are not feel they are not complete, they are not aware of what is healthy lifestyle, what are the basic things like not smoking, healthy diet, exercise. For those kind of for the advices on those topics, it's worthwhile to go and see a doctor preventatively.
Actually, I'm surprised that you say that, because it sounds like you're saying that doctors are still good health educators, and I have not seen that. I've not seen doctors being well-versed in nutrition and various other things.
You're right. And that's what one of the things prompted for me for writing the book is the trend has been in the opposite direction, is away from these really very simple basic things that yield the most to something very obscure, high technology and bioscience to give an impression that something great is being done where in fact it isn't. So, yes, I'm speaking about a hypothetical doctor who is really
right.
Natural health minded.
Well, there are a few of them around still. I'm old enough to remember the family physician who would come to your house when you were ill and would do as much just ministering to you emotionally as anything else, and they were sort of medical educators. Often they would be able to perceive if a situation was maybe something where somebody just needed to be listened to or heard or was frightened or something like that. So that's sort of gone by the wayside, but I wonder what realistic expectations would be for someone entering the medical system at this point, because we're sort of where we are, and although I think consumers will be the people who will instigate change by demanding different things from their doctors, for now, if you're not going to be educated particularly by your doctor, what are realistic expectations in this environment to get by going to a doctor?
Okay. First, of course, if there's some distressing symptom that the person has and they want information, it would be to get an idea of what the regular allopathic medicine can offer, and what are the risks, what are the benefits, and what is the magnitude of help one can expect from whatever is being offered. So basic information, and try to, the most helpful attitude is to maintain the locus of control within yourself as opposed to delegating it to a doctor.
Boy, do I agree with you about that. When you say that you should be getting information about what sorts of diagnostic tools can be used to look into your symptom and what the risks and benefits are, is it your experience from someone who's been inside the medical establishment that doctors actually can speak to the risks and benefits of testing, or that they pretty much just kind of sense that this is what should be done and they start pushing?
It, again, depends on the doctor you happen to be with. The unfortunate trend has been that because of the various pressures to for doctors to push the procedures without discussing the risks and benefits, so that one, for a variety of reasons, like staying in compliance with the guidelines and avoiding exposure to risks from malpractice and so on. If you happen to see the kind of a doctor who is in a hurry and tries to get through the visit quickly, you may not be able to get that information and actually may irritate the doctor by trying to obtain it. But this would be a sign that this is a doctor that you don't want to see.
That seems clear to me. One of the things I often say to people who come to me as a health educator is that you can fire your doctor. It's like working with any independent contractor that you hire. They should be doing things the way that you would like them to, and if they don't, then you should move on to someone else. Why don't you describe, especially again from the inside out, what happens in the training of doctors in the issue of how to handle patients? I'm thinking here of things you talk about in the book about being trained not to spend a lot of time talking to people, and why is that?
It's tied into the payment system, since the whole healthcare has become very expensive, it has to pay for itself. To keep up with an overhead, most doctors nowadays, primary care at least, general internist, family physician, OBGYN, will have 15-minute slots in which they have to see the patient. Now, that 15 minutes doesn't mean that that's the time spent with the patient. It includes the time with the patient plus charting, billing, coding, answering phone calls, doing refills of medications. So you have at best 10 minutes. You're supposed to under unfortunate circumstances, convince the patient, and sometimes it is presented in that way. You have to convince the patient to follow the algorithm given by the guidelines. The guidelines were intended in their best potential to provide something useful and not to miss harmful things. But in their worst potential, unfortunately, they sometimes act to cause harm by forcing a variety of procedures and treatments on patients who would benefit from something else or nothing at all.
Again, part of my mission, both with this show and also with our practice, is to coach people so that they are educated enough to use that 10 minutes very succinctly and very economically, so that they don't go in there and feel ignored by people, by doctors. And because often people go in and what they want is to be heard, that part of the process. And again, it goes back to the old family doctor who did used to come over and have a cup of tea and talk to you. And if you were a child, they'd be talking to your parents, and they'd come in and spend time with you, and that's gone. So people still have this need to be heard, and what they do is bounce from one doctor to another rather than getting educated on their own first and going in with very succinct list of questions or concerns. So that's what I tell people. What do you tell people if they feel ignored?
First, it starts with your own attitude with which you go in, which you, as you yourself gave an analogy of using the doctor as a contractor. I actually give almost identical analogy in my book. With that attitude in mind, that the doctor is there for you. From there, if the person is not getting the answer, they should feel comfortable politely, but also firmly to state what they're there for, that whatever the priorities the doctor may perceive as more important are not as important to them, and that their primary priorities is such and such, and they would like first to have those answered.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Oleg Reznik, R-E-Z-N-I-K, M-D. His book is The Secrets of Medical Decision-Making, How to Avoid Becoming a Victim of the Healthcare Machine. One of the things that might be interesting to discuss, because you discuss it so clearly in the book, is how it is that doctors become trained, because this ties in very closely with why they're so in love with all these expensive tests and many, many pharmaceuticals for treating them, how it is that they're trained so that that happens. Because, in fact, many people who go to doctors end up getting overtreated. And this is one of the benefits of your book is that, I mean, it's very close to my heart. You're teaching people about what the long-term circumstances, what the unintended consequences are of being overtreated. So tell us a little bit about how it is that doctors have gotten on this fast-moving train where they're pushing a lot of expensive treatments and tests.
Yes, so it has also several components. In my mind, it starts first with the medical model on which we base today's medicine, which is has certain philosophical presuppositions that only what is measurable is important, and causality is the universal law. So from there, the thinking naturally evolves into biotechnological medicine, and the mind being within this framework, only a highly organized part of the brain is not considered important. So from there, it's only the physical and the measurable is important. So you go to your doctor, it's your weight, your blood pressure, your cholesterol numbers, blood sugar, and so on. Those are the numbers considered most important, explicitly or implicitly. And then the doctor, of course, feels pressured addressing those first. The other things have to come second and are not as important. That's only just the attitude to begin with. Then the evaluation process of the physicians during their training also happens based on these quantitative measures, and it's getting more and more sophisticated. The most recent system of reimbursement is called pay-per-performance, which involves checking the numbers and paying the doctors based on how well their patient panel fits into the numbers.
Which numbers are we talking about?
So the number for, let's say if it's a diabetic, the numbers for blood cholesterol.
Parameters.
Parameters, yeah. So the numbers for the various parameters, like the blood pressure, the cholesterol.
So that's how they get paid. Is if you're, I suddenly just got so angry. Part of the reason I got angry is because there's so much manipulation by the pharmaceutical companies of those parameters. There's a very initiated insider person that we've had on the show many times, who's a lipid researcher and who's worked with the food industry and with the government. And she was privy to some meetings where the pharmaceutical industry was pushing to lower the acceptable limits on cholesterol levels, knowing that a normal cholesterol level for somebody in their 50s or above might be somewhere around 250. They said, well, we won't get compliance unless we say 200. So they lowered it, and now they're doing it even more. They're lowering it to a point where it's unhealthy, where because there are consequences for not having enough cholesterol. I mean, all of these functions of the body are there for a reason. So following the parameters and being paid more for the parameters is really a way to put money back in the pharmaceutical companies' pockets.
Yes, and that was my next step in this.
Oh, sorry, I'm sorry. I just got
sure. So the effect of the commerce in medicine is enormous, and as we are in the United States, probably the most commercialized society in the world. It has to be turned, everything has to make profit. So the medical industry has an enormous impact on the making of guidelines. There is a great deal of participation within the teaching community, so it starts with teaching of medical students, because the faculty, like myself, I am now a faculty at the university, teaching both residents and medical students, generally get paid less than the outpatient docs who are not in teaching, so many of them grow to rely on so-called sponsorship or support from the pharmaceuticals. And this is known, but you know, the extent of it is not really appreciated, how the pharma, the big pharmaceutical companies, have a way of influencing the guideline-making process.
What happens to doctors who do not comply with standard of care?
Their life is difficult, and you know, I'm one of them to some extent, and there are a variety of attacks that you expose yourself to from colleagues, and the potential danger from a patient. Potential, I say, because you know, thankfully, I haven't been attacked by the patient. But the guidelines also provide legal protection. In other words, if the patient has what is called bad outcome, something bad happens. It doesn't matter if what the doctor did was within the guidelines. The doctor may have done something that was not okay for this particular patient. But as long as he is acting within the guidelines, he's protected against a lawsuit. On the other hand, as soon as you step out of that guideline, you expose yourself to the liability, and it's not only yourself, but if you're working for a large institution, the institution does not want to be exposed. So the doctor has problems with the hospital. When you work in the hospital says, well, you're exposing the hospital to a lawsuit. When you work for a university, the university may not be comfortable saying, well, you're exposing us, and so on. So there's a variety of factors, and people really dislike whenever you are deviating from guidelines.
And again, this is not necessarily because the patient will have a good outcome if you follow the guidelines. In fact, what your book exposes is that people have very poor outcomes because they sort of enter the system, and then they sort of lose their freedom after that. I mean, there's this kind of trajectory that happens, and you begin to lose your ability to make decisions because it's kind of one thing leads to another. So I think it's one of the things that I was talking about is unintended consequences of entering the system by being tested and getting all these treatments. And I'd like you to sort of take that part on. And it's motivated by fear. So I'd like you to address that. You do it very well in your book.
The system itself, or the fear aspect?
What I'm saying is that doctors who themselves are being pressured by fear of various things,
yes,
use fear as a wedge to get their clients to be compliant, or their patients to be compliant. And then what happens is that the patients don't realize when they're afraid that once they walk into the system, that the system is a machine, and once they're in the middle of that machine, they begin to lose and abrogate their freedom to make further decisions about what will happen next.
Yes. The fear is, of course, very powerful motivator for both doctors and patients, and it never leads to anything good. So the doctor who is fearful, the doctor is fearful of liability, of what if something bad happens, and something bad invariably happens because we are human beings, we are mortal. We will get sick and we will die regardless of what medical profession does. This just is inevitable. However, once this happens, then the doctor feels, in our society more than in others, liable for, you know, someone can sue him. So how can he protect himself by staying within the guidelines? So now the doctors often feel pressured to convince the patient to fit into the guidelines. And, of course, the most powerful motivator, again, becomes the fear. And people, patients who are coming in already somewhat afraid, someone comes in, they're experiencing something distressing to them, they are already afraid. If they are then told, well, you should get this, this, and that, and they are perhaps saying, well, what could I not get this because of all these side effects that may happen? And, well, yeah, if you don't get it, you may have cancer or something else. So a statement of that kind or analogous that produces a great amount of fear is sometimes used.
Not sometimes.
Yeah, quite often.
Yes.
and unfortunately, it's a trap that's difficult to escape. It takes a great deal of self-awareness on the side of the patient to become aware first of one's being fearful and then to say no to the course of actions that fear motivates. But it's always a wrong course of actions.
You give some very good examples in the book of why it's not a good idea to get, quote, tough on your doctor. That you know, mm-hmm. pressuring a doctor for treatment,
yes.
could actually cause the patient tremendous suffering and even a premature death. Do you want to speak to that?
Yes. It happens not uncommonly. Sometimes the patients and sometimes the family will pressure doctors, and it comes from really a wish to obtain help. The patient and the family feel distressed. They have an underlying belief that the medical system is able to fix, if not everything, almost everything. And from there, they experiencing some kind of a problem not being addressed or things not getting better, start sometimes pressuring and stating that, you know, why are you not doing more? Why is this not fixed? We are going to complain and so forth and so on, and sometimes may threaten a doctor in this situation. It's a dire situation often. However, it produces really the opposite of the effect that they were hoping for, because I think everyone hopes that their loved one or themselves would be approached with genuine care, compassion, and with their best interest at heart. However, that doesn't happen in this case. When you invoke fear, when you try to threaten, you're really out of your league in terms of knowledge of what is biotechnological medicine capable of. And the doctor senses what you want, that you want an impression of something being done, and you will get what you want in terms of something will be done to you. Now, that what is being done is not necessarily going to help, but more likely to actually increase the suffering. You will get a variety of tests, consultations. All the tests involve some kind of at least unpleasantness with them and possible harm. So patients this is something that happens every day. Because they pressure the doctor to fix not being satisfied with what's happening, they get a kind of a fired back with a bunch of tests that puts them through a great deal in the end. If they're lucky, they're told, well, we didn't find anything, or what we found, nothing can be done about. And if they're not lucky, then they may experience false positive results and the consequences of those, the further workup and further suffering. Every test, absolutely every test, including the most precise, like a biopsy, has a rate of false positives. In other words, it will come back as if something is there abnormal, and in fact, it's normal. So the more tests you do, the more likely you will have a false positive, and the more likely you will suffer.
Yeah, in fact, what I try to get people to understand is that you are more likely to be overtreated than undertreated. That, especially if you pressure the machine, what will happen is they will fire back with all guns, and you will end up getting a lot of very aggressive treatment that could actually cause an early death for your loved one or yourself. We're going to need to take just a brief musical break. I am Lena Berman. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. We are on the phone with Dr. Oleg, Oleg Reznik, Reznik. MD. His book is The Secrets of Medical Decision Making: How to Avoid Becoming a Victim of the Healthcare Machine. We're going to break briefly for some music. Stay with us.
I've got you under my skin. I have got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart, you're really a part of me. And I have got you under my skin. I have tried so not to give in. I've said to myself this affair, it never would go so well. But why should I try to resist when I know so that I've got you under my skin?
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, on the phone with Dr. Oleg Reznik, R-E-Z-N-I-K. He is a physician who has written a book called The Secrets of Medical Decision Making. There is a free stream of this week's show, information about guests, the Progressive Health Observer, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. Please note, the July appearance has been canceled. Dr. Reznik, do you have a website that you would like to give out?
Yes, my website is www.olegreznikmd. It's O-L-E-G-R-E-Z-N-I-K, all in one word. MD.com, and it has lots of information on what we speak about now and some of the current issues and debates that come up in the media as well.
So again, it's OLEGREZNIKMD with no periods .com.
Right.
Okay. So one of the places where we see overtreatment and fear used the most is with cancer and cancer screening. And in fact, you even quote one of our favorite guests from the past, Dr. Welsh, who wrote a book, Should I Be Treated for Cancer? Should You Be Treated for Cancer? Maybe Not, Here's Why. But you also go even a step further than Dr. Welsh, because you take on mammography and even colonoscopies. And the important point here, and this is something I feel very strongly about, is you have a wonderful story about someone who does go through a colonoscopy and has some bad outcomes as a result. One of the things that people don't think about not only is how invasive is the test. Somebody goes in with gastrointestinal symptoms and then has to purge their system the day before, which is extremely irritating. And then they go in with this garden hose with a light on it that's, I forget how many feet you said, 12 feet or something? Something like that, yeah. And there's research showing that they're not getting cleaned as well as they ought to, that they can cause infections, that they often cut off more items that they found along the way that are not really significant and cause irritation and are expensive, and in the worst case, perforate the colon. So I would like you to talk about what you should be prepared to think about or do when you're facing the idea of cancer screening. What kind of decision are you really making there?
Yes, it's about 6 feet, not 12. But
12, okay. 6 feet.
But,
it's long enough.
It doesn't make it any less unpleasant. So, yes, how to approach cancer screening is a difficult question in our environment, where you get bombarded with information. In fact, on a regular basis, as I go in a local supermarket, they have a message playing, please remember to screen for your prostate cancer and PSA and so on. Even though the prostate, one of the, you know, there is a the breast cancer screening, colon cancer screening, and prostate cancer screening, the three main cancers, and in the young women, cervical cancer. But the prostate is the one that even the mainstream medicine, now most of the guideline producing agencies state that there is no clear evidence of it being helpful, and the physician can discuss pros and cons with the patient, and it's reasonable to do it or not to do it. So even with that, we're still being bombarded because, again, it's a financially driven society to a large degree, and screening is what produces most of the customers for the healthcare system. You get screened, and the screening tests are not well known to produce high degree of false positives. And then you get through the follow-up and so on. But, of course, the idea was to catch the cancer early and to treat it so that we make people live longer. Now, neither breast cancer screening nor colon cancer screening, and, of course, not prostate, has been shown to save lives. When we speak of total mortality, I have to explain what that is. When you hear normally research being quoted and someone saying that, well, there is a 17% reduction in breast cancer death, that's called the cancer-specific mortality. To put it in layman's term, it's really artifact of the type of calculation that's being done. When you look at the patients who get the treatment, they may die from something else in the process of treatment, and they will not be counted as cancer-specific deaths. So when you speak of cancer-specific death, it looks like there is an improvement. However, the studies, which are more difficult to do, that look at total mortality, in other words, did people who get screened overall live longer than people who did not get screened, the answer is no. Right now, there is no data available to suggest that that's the case. There's, you know, there are studies have been done on all of those types of cancers, and they have not shown that. So it's more based on hope than on evidence.
Well, in fact, what you talk about in the book is that there are the statistics, because they're based on cancer deaths. So it looks like somebody survived cancer. Very often, what happens when people are, you know, it's this thing where they do a cancer screening like a colonoscopy, use that as an example, and they find a little something, and the pathologist tests it. And again, there's chances of false positives. They say it's something terrible. The patient is prepped and wheeled right into the OR and has open abdominal surgery, and they remove part of the colon. Now, that's extremely invasive, and if the patient is a little bit elderly or vulnerable in some other way, what can happen is that after a while they get a pneumonia or an infection from all of this, and they die of that. But that doesn't get shown in the statistics as a death from colon cancer. That gets shown as a death, a success of the colon cancer screening, and it doesn't. It's different. It's not the same thing. So that's one of the problems.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Well, this is from your book. I'm quoting you. You know, okay. So your book is quite wonderful. I mean, I'm very, very happy with it. I'll say the name again, The Secrets of Medical Decision Making. This is, again, Oleg Reznik, R-E-Z-N-I-K, M-D, and his website is OLEGREZNIKMD.com. And I do urge people to get this book. It is a very tiny publisher. Lovinghealing.com is the website. This was the only book on their... Oh, I shouldn't say that. But anyway, this was the book.
No, they have other books.
They have other books, but I wasn't
this
thrilled.
One is available through all major, you know, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. And
so. Okay. So the cancer screening leaves people open to cancer treatments that sometimes prolong their lives. Sometimes they only prolong their lives by 78 days or something, but
yeah.
Causes tremendous suffering. So cancer, we've sort of covered that. Another one that's a big deal is childbirth. And to quote you, sometimes you say in childbirth, informed consent isn't informative. Do you want to explain what you mean?
Yes. It's the issue of informed consent, of course, was intended to provide information to the patient, but it tends really not to be that. The doctor is in a position to present information in a way that will almost always get the patient to do what the doctor wants. You know, it's a vulnerable time, and a woman wants to be confident and trust the doctor they're with. And the doctor may happen to be an ethical and honest doctor, but you are not usually just with one doctor. There is a consultation process. If things don't go well, you have a specialist, someone else coming in that you're seeing for the first time. The informed consent sometimes actually is just a tool, unfortunately, to convince the patient to do something and then to protect the doctor, to say that, well, we have explained that there were risks, the patient understood and agreed, and that's it. So it has to be taken with a grain of salt as far as how informed it is.
Well, and then there's also a lot of things that you don't get to make decisions about with childbirth if you're a woman. And, you know, for instance, what happens to the newborn right after birth? What sorts of things get put in his or her eyes, or his being tested for certain things and inoculated and stuff? You don't always have a choice.
Yes, and this is getting more and more so. There is a principle in medicine that is taken from aviation. The kind of principles they use in flying the airlines, the planes, at the airports, where they try to take measures that would remove even the most remote possibility of a problem. Now, what that entails is that everyone has to be plugged into the kind of a uniform line and get everything done the same way. Whenever there's a deviation, this is very difficult and puts a strain, and people will try to really fight you about it. So if you want, I would say, if you want to have any sort of say about what's done to you, it's easier in a smaller place, smaller hospital, more difficult, and requires really work with a doctor in a bigger place where everything just absolutely has to be done according to the protocol, and you lose most of your autonomy as a patient.
Well, and I think that the message of your book is that it's only in recent history that we have this extremely high-tech, expensive, fear-based medical system, which, incidentally, our mortality rates are higher, our life expectancy is shorter, and our infant mortality rates are higher than some undeveloped, you know, some, well, I shouldn't say undeveloped, some developing countries, and certainly in lots of places in Europe. So we're kind of, I think, in the 37th percentile or something. I mean, we're not, for all of this money that we spend and all these rules that we're following and all these fancy treatments and machines, we're not doing very well. And what people forget, and I think what your book does a very good job of explaining, is that we're not actually walking on a tightrope as human beings. I mean, yes, we are going to die, and we're mortal, and we can get sick, and things can happen, but there is something to be said for, in a situation where you actually, you know, like with the cancer, it isn't that we're saying never get treated if you have symptoms of cancer, or if you have a terrible family history and you want to be checked out, you may make that decision, but you need to understand the consequences of the decision if they find something. But in fact, what we're saying is maybe wait until you actually have symptoms, because the research doesn't support treating before that in many cases. Maybe, I don't know, in colon cancer, some people could argue that, but in fact, people do have symptoms sometimes and don't have colon cancer. So it's very, very tricky. And some people don't have symptoms at all and have it. It's very tricky. But that people are so afraid now that they feel as if they're walking on the edge of a razor blade. And it's very easy for them to get toppled in either way into a pit full of sort of vicious beasts and serpents or something. And that isn't really the way life is. The body has a kind of wisdom to it. If you care for it in the most sensible way, you know, sort of like, my grandparents come from Eastern Europe, and I remember, you know, my grandmother's cure for everything, which was soup, mm-hmm. and fluids and resting and stroking your hair and those things. A lot can be said for people stopping and taking a day or two. I often say this to people: before you panic, to give yourself a day of rest and see what's going on. And so many of the symptoms that people have are symptoms of fear and overexertion, and even in the elderly to some extent. Anyway, I've gone on for a bit. Did you want to comment? I think one last thing I do want to say is that I wonder also whether the fact that you worked as a nurse before you got trained as a doctor is part of the reason that you have this kind of take care in a kind of warm, humanistic kind of way, whether, because I always think that nurses are on the front lines of really caring for patients.
As far as nursing, there's no doubt that it has contributed to me feeling less removed from the patient, but being right there and experiencing, even when I was a nurse, I remember experiences where the doctors made the decision and I was, as a nurse, there with the patient, seeing how this was really not benefiting the patient at all. So, yes, this, I think, had an important impact, and I'm grateful for having had that experience. The other part of your comment, I think, is the most important, that something I hoped to convey by doing this book is that there is no by removing the dependence on the system, I was hoping people would find a way of self-reliance, that there is a world out there besides the biotechnological medicine, that there is something to say about your own fighting spirit, the will to live, the basic things of what is healthy, one's own decision-making. Relying on the medical field, it may have some useful information, but by extruding yourself from this complete dependence, I hoped that that each person would then look outside of this box and try to see what else is there and find this vastness that's available there. There's not at all fatalism in this book. It is not meant to discourage people in any way, only to reduce dependence, to be able to face whatever life experience they go through in depending on more on themselves and less on other technological things around them.
In fact, the most corrosive, physically corrosive and health corrosive stress effect is from helplessness. Feeling of helplessness, and I do think that people need to protect themselves from that sense of helplessness, and if they do enter a medical environment, to go in, as you say, with their own sense of themselves and what they want intact. And I think your book does a really good job of helping people kind of run through the different choices they're going to be faced with. Now, you do end the book by talking about end-of-life issues, and you say something that I've heard other people who've written about the issue say, which is that although almost everybody that's interviewed in any kind of study or even anecdotally about where they want to die, they all say they want to die at home, and yet almost nobody does. And the reason is because there's always a crisis that occurs. Somebody calls 911, an ambulance shows up, and pretty soon the patient is in the system. So talk about some of the important things that people need to think about before that happens, dealing with end of life.
Yes. This is an important topic, I think, for the culture of the United States, where we tend to avoid the subject of death as much as possible. So most of us are not prepared to face it when it does come, in ourselves or in the family member. And then not feeling ready to face it, then of course it's delegated to the system. People are hoping that the doctor or the hospital, the specialist, will tell them the right thing to do. They feel unprepared completely to deal themselves with those decisions. And of course the doctor and the specialist, the evidence shows, does not offer what is optimal. People not only end up dying hooked up to the machinery, and the evidence actually shows that having more intense interventions at the end of life shortens life a little bit, definitely does not prolong it. And this is people who are very sick or very elderly. There is no doubt about that. But nevertheless, patients and their family on a regular basis, making a choice not to take up these decisions on themselves, which are admittedly very difficult, and choose to delegate it to the system, and that is a mistake.
Well, in fact, I think there are statistics that show that at the end of life, when patients often opt for hospice care, that what they discover is that they live longer than they were expected to live because they're just comfortable in being cared for and being loved, and they have access to their loved ones who can be with them at the bedside, and that actually they live longer because of that. What sorts of things did you want people to do ahead of time to protect themselves on a personal level? I mean, have you seen any of these advanced directives being followed? I mean, I think probably the most important thing is to have a health proxy, medical proxy.
Yes, healthcare proxy, a person whom you trust and who really understands you and your wishes, who is also confident enough not to be swayed in the end. I have seen this work sometimes quite well. There are some family members who are really in tune with what their loved one wished, and they will argue with the doctors even when the doctor is wanting to do more or so on. And often it works. You have to have someone like that. Not everyone has a person like that who is both able to handle it is also able to be confident enough to be firm about the wishes and their fulfillment. So what can they do? Is to first face it themselves and decide what they would want, and then speak with the people who would be their healthcare proxy, who would be making decisions in the end, and be very clear about that.
Well, of course, one of the reasons it's complicated when somebody gets into a hospital is that physicians and hospitals understand death as a failure, and death isn't the worst thing that can happen to a person. There's a lot of suffering along the way that can happen. Death can be, as somebody that works in the homeopathic field once said, sometimes death is the only way that the organism can actually heal itself. You know, it's the only way for this to get resolved is death, and sometimes that's a good outcome if somebody is suffering terribly. You quote Buddhist spiritual master of the 8th century, Shantideva, who said, if all the harms, fears, and suffering in the world arise from self-grasping, what need have I for such a great evil spirit? And I thought, boy, you just don't need hell if you've got a medical establishment that believes that the natural process of being alive and dying is not to be allowed. So, you know, you don't have to be afraid of the terrorists. You've got things happening right now that can be, you know, anyway, so death isn't the worst outcome. It's not what everybody wants to have happen, but there's something to be said for helping your loved ones and also planning for yourself to have a good death or a quiet, peaceful, tranquil period when that's happening so that you can be aware of what's going on.
Yes. How one dies is important, and for that one has to first accept one's own mortality and then face that question. And if you don't, hoping that someone else or medical system will do it is not realistic, because the system is based on commercial interests and other competing interests, and so it won't happen by hoping that someone else will do it.
So I have two questions that are a little more personal. You have the option to answer or not. One is that I have had the great pleasure of interviewing Dr. Stanislaw Brzezinski, the cancer specialist, who is also from Poland. And his experience coming to the United States was that he had much less freedom in the United States, even though he was coming from a Poland that was still Soviet bloc. I don't know how old you were when you left Poland, but I'm wondering...
Ukraine.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're from the Ukraine, so it's not Poland. Forgive me. I should know better because that's sort of the area where my grandparents are from. How you come to understand, I mean, how this is interesting for you coming from a country that, you know, always thinks the United... Well, anyway, you know what I'm asking, I think.
Yes. When I came, I was 18.
Yeah.
So I didn't have much sense of how system functions there. I have more sense of that actually now when I'm seeing patients who are coming to see me since I'm Russian-Ukrainian speaking, and they have had other doctors treat them there. And so I do get a sense that the freedom of the doctor and the patient was much greater and is still
in Eastern Europe.
Yes,
better in Eastern Europe. See, now there's a thought, huh?
It's changing. You know, everyone it seems is getting into the spirit of technological medicine. This is kind of a, unfortunately, new god of the age.
Mm-hmm.
So I think unfortunately it's going in that direction, but it's behind, which is a good thing so far.
And the last question is, what has the study of visualization, of dealing with the mind, taught you about healing?
That taught me, since this is something I do, I have a so-called mind-body medicine clinic in addition to the regular medicine. The healing does not come from any external intervention. The external intervention can help manage the symptoms. The healing always comes from within, the person's own self-transformative intervention. And each person has to find their own way, but it comes from himself.
That's really profound. I think that's one of the things that we discover in some of the more traditional modalities like acupuncture and herbal medicine and homeopathy, is that there is a healing energy that can be mobilized and that can be strengthened and can be supported instead of overridden.
Yes, and that the first step in that is becoming independent and more self-reliant in realizing that the answers ultimately are not somewhere among some experts that will tell you what to do, but the ultimate answers are within the person.
Healing from the inside out.
Yes.
So you've been listening to an interview with Oleg Reznik. Don't go away, I'm going to thank you. It's OlegReznikMD.com, OlegReznik.com, MD.com, OlegReznikMD.com. His book is The Secrets of Medical Decision-Making, which can be purchased anywhere you look. I want to really thank you for this book. I'm so happy that you wrote it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Lena, for having me on the show.
It was such a pleasure. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, including the information, that the July event has been canceled. Our guests, the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine, and a free stream of this week's show, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.